Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The guessing game is well underway in Washington. Who will replace Supreme Court Justice David Souter? We'll have the latest. But first, an extraordinary look at obsessive-compulsive disorder. Not just the urge to wash your hands over and over, but a severe disability. Ed Zein thinks his OCD began when he was just 11 years old and witnessed the moment his mother died of cancer. That grew into an illogical belief that through complex rituals, he could freeze time or rewind events and therefore protect the rest of his family. Here's a reading of Ed's own thoughts while trying to eat pasta.
If a strand of pasta touches face, lip, or chin and does not go into mouth, gently try to grab strand with thumb and index finger of other hand, letting fingers touch only pasta, not each other. If fingers touch each other, reverse entire process and start over. Make sure fingers do not touch face or lips. If they do, start touching and counting rituals. Touch skin on face with thumb and index finger, right, left, right, left, right, left, repeatedly until comfortable, multiples of even numbers, sometimes up to magic number of 16,384.
Ed Zein's OCD became so bad that he couldn't leave the basement of his home on Cape Cod. His family eventually appealed to one of the top specialists in the field, Dr. Michael Jenneke, a Harvard professor who's founded OCD programs at Mass General and McLean Hospitals here in the Boston area, and someone known as a maverick for his outreach to patients. Jenneke wasn't able to help Ed at first, but with the help of a Star Wars costume, a mailman who helped Ed receive that costume, and Ed's own willpower, he's managed his disorder. His story is told in Life in Rewind, a new book written with author Terry Weibel Murphy. And Ed Zein and Michael Jenneke both join us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
Ed, I have to start with you. Did you really count in multiples of even numbers up to 16,384?
I did. For me, what it is as demand got higher to satisfy OCD, the number got higher, and therefore 8 and 8 is 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, and so on. And it just countless on hours I could be taking, sometimes 7.5 to 10 hours to either get to the bathroom, to get to the phone. You know, it just started to slowly deteriorate me and my body.
Well, and explain what your thinking was. I kind of paraphrased it, that you were almost thinking like if you could constantly erase what you'd done, you'd stay frozen in time. Is that
right? Me seeing my mom pass in a time when you need help, your body creates a defense mechanism. And for me, I say you need the two C's, closure to the problem and the coping skills so you don't regress. And I didn't get that. And a defensive mechanism is sort of the safety parameters that are created to give you comfort, like a security blanket.
Well, a lot of us know this feeling. I mean, I used to, every time I got on a plane, I had to make sure I thought of each member of my family in a certain order, you know, just to make sure nothing would happen to them. You know, a lot of people have sort of a window to this behavior. But can you tell us about, you know, how the beginnings?
See, for me, it's important to say that as illogical as it may seem, logically, I understood that you cannot control things. But in a time when you need help, your body creates OCD. And OCD uses your traumas, your experiences, and your fears against you as sort of a pressure point.
You had, through this then, it seemed, your rational mind as well. Well, I just want to bring Dr. Jenneke, you said I can call you Michael, in at this point, because as I was reading it, this seemed what distinguishes this serious OCD from even, you know, psychotic breaks.
There is normal thinking, there's psychotic thinking, and OCD is sort of a breed all of its own. And in OCD, people cognitively are intact. Ed knew that he couldn't reverse time intellectually. But he had a feeling in his gut or wherever that lives in the brain that he could reverse time and he could keep people alive by reversing time.
Right.
So you have, there's a disconnect in OCD between what you know intellectually and what you feel. And pretty much people go with what they feel, even though their brain says, this is nuts, I'm not going to take a chance.
Right.
It's almost like superstitious thing has gone totally awry and you can't control it.
Some of the stuff is, it would seem comical, but it's not. For instance, rotaries were intolerable for you. These are these traffic circles we have here in Massachusetts because you couldn't figure out a way to undo, you know, a trip through a rotary.
And that's why I got out to walk around them, because
You get out of the car.
I'd have to get out either before and walk around. So when I came back, I came the right way. Or I'd get in the car and we'd go around it the correct way. And then I'd get out. So either way, I'd walk because that's a safety issue. And you never want to put anybody in danger. And for me, I'm about sort of protecting life. And if you look at it, it's the fear, which I still can't say to today, the fear of DEATH.
Oh, let's stop you there. You can't say that
word. I can't say it. You know why? Because of my heart and sensitivity, because I love life and people. It's like I'm sort of, I like protecting people. I don't like bullies, and Big M doesn't like. And for me,
Big
I call Big M.
Big M is Michael. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Big M I refer to as Big Brother Mike, because to a point when I saw Big M, the first time that Big M had come to the house, to me, I still see myself like that. And to me, my pain I still live with on a daily basis.
Well, I have to say for our radio listeners, I'm looking at you. You call Michael, the doctor, a Big M. I'm looking at Big Ed. I mean, you are, you've got the forearms of the football player you once were. You're a big guy, obviously big heart. And the pictures of you when you're in the basement and in the depths of OCD with your fingers splayed apart, you held them there rigidly because they couldn't touch.
I was down to 159 pounds, that close to passing away.
Well, Dr. Janicki, Michael.
Boy, now aren't you going to tell me I'm pretty muscular, too?
No, not compared to this guy.
He's a smooth one. He's a smoothie.
Well, how did you feel when you were allowed, the family turned to you when Ed was living in the basement, not washing, I mean, he was just really kind of fetid, and he finally allowed you there. It was all you could do. You could hardly breathe.
All I wanted to do was get out of there. But our goal was to get him into the shower. He hadn't had one for a couple of years, something like that. And it smelled pretty bad in there. I don't want to embarrass him.
No,
but
you're
not embarrassing me, believe
let,
me.
He let that all go into the book, which is amazing that he's, you know, able to do that. But it was pretty rough, and he was stuck, and nothing could be touched because it had moved into the future. But we got him in the shower, and the shower scene is pretty amazing. He remembers all the details of that.
Hours and hours, Ed, just to take a razor and shave. Are you upset?
Just so many days when you talk about it, just has to.
Yeah. 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 Take your time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it?
No, it's just, you know, kind of like you live your life. You just, the whole process of me doing this was to honor Big M for his humanity, his compassion that he showed me. And it was in 98 when I saw you break down that hit me in here.
Yeah.
And that's when I wanted to make the choice to get better.
The moment that Ed was just talking about, Michael, is a moment when you'd worked together for quite a while,
mm-hmm.
and realized that it wasn't medication that was going to help this, and that maybe it wasn't even going to be therapy. And you burst into tears. I mean, you'd brought your daughter, who's a behavioral therapist, and it just wasn't working. You burst into tears. And that seemed to be a real launching pad for you. What happened?
Because somebody took their time out of their life to come see me. And that quagmire of crap, it's like I felt angry at OCD because I didn't want, even as screwed up as my life was, I didn't want Big M to feel any pain. And just because I go through that hell doesn't mean you have to go through it. And if you know me and understand me, if anything, my OCD, the opposite, I don't want it affecting other people. And there's some points where it can afflict other people, and that's why I lived the hell that I did by myself in that house.
That anger, though, that you had seemed to be the moment where OCD started to loosen its grip on you. And it's just an incredible story. I'll try to synopsize a little bit. This is what brings us to The Empire Strikes Back, believe it or not, because this had been a favorite film of yours, and you tried to get a Darth Vader costume because that meant a lot to you when you were a child, and you thought that could help you. And along this path, I mean, it's just incredible. You meet some of the most lovely people. The guy who used to make the costumes, a guy named Don Post, who decides to help you. Your postmaster on Cape Cod,
Peter.
No, he'd made a pledge to God. If his child survived cancer, he would do anything for God. And he sees you as, since his child did live, he sees you as someone sent from God to help. He starts helping you. And these people along the way help you, Ed, represent yourself to Michael a year later. Now, Michael, what was it? In addition to Ed's determination, what else happened?
Well, I talked to Ed on the phone. I didn't come down for many months. And the next time I came down, he'd been weightlifting. He had a suntan. He wasn't in the basement. He came down the driveway. I had no idea who he was until he opened his mouth.
That still floors me.
It floors him. But he looked so different. But once he spoke, obviously, I knew who it was. So he worked this out in his brain. The way he's saying, I don't really understand what he's saying, how he redid it, but I've heard him tell it many times. But he figured out a way to use the behavioral techniques.
Can you find it in there? Like the sort of, that's what I've been thinking that since last night and just thinking, trying to find
on it. Yeah.
The connect of what I did to apply that to others as a schematic and a blueprint.
In reading it, it just seems some sort of magic potion of deciding you were going to do it and then allowing some people like a postmaster to help you do it and take these baby steps. And then what? What else? What do you think?
For me, I think it's just finding the way to manage it so that you can be a functioning human being. And I know, see, I've come to terms. I know I'll never be rid of my OCD, but I learned to work with it.
Yeah.
That gives me the comfort because I don't have to live up to expectations. And then by God, maybe someday it'll be completely gone because that's the, you know, don't bite off more than I can chew. That's
right.
The philosophy. And that's what Big M has taught me in a lot of ways of how to approach myself. So
yeah.
That accolade would go to you.
Big M, he gestures over at you. What do you say about OCD? What do we know about it? Is it biological?
We know that there are brain differences between people with OCD and without. There's a little more gray matter. There's less white matter, connection fibers. It's genetic in some families. We have a huge genetic study that's now being analyzed at Mass General Hospital. But our biological understanding of the disorder lags way behind our treatment abilities. We can treat people now, most people, and get them dramatically better, even though we don't understand what's going on in the brain exactly. So that's the understanding is going to come after the treatment. But that's great for patients.
Yeah.
We know what to do now.
Well, there's medications and behavioral therapies. It just Ed's case was a real tough one and
right.
Needed a little more than that.
What happened with that is I tried the behavioral therapy, tried the medication over some years. Nothing seemed to work. I had pretty much given up. I didn't think I was going to really be able to help Ed and just was willing to be his friend and go visit him. I think turning into his friend, that's why some of the thing about breaking the rules, doctors aren't supposed to be friends with their patients, but I figure if he's in a basement down in Cape Cod, no one will know I'm his friend, so it'll be safe.
I think it's not, I wouldn't classify it as the friendship. I would classify it as humanity. And it's funny, as I will say, in today's society, that humanity is now considered the unconventional medicine. So it had less to do with the others as far as medicine that, and that's the part where the connect and honor came in just to who I am.
Well, Ed, you have fallen in love. You've married, built a home. You're the father of two children. Do you worry, you know, about that past coming back at you?
Or? I already have an answer for that.
Go.
Every day when I look at Mayada and I look into my girl's eyes, that's every reason I need to fight my OCD.
That's Ed Zine. He and Dr. Michael Jenneke are co-authors, along with Terry Weibel Murphy, of Life in Rewind, the story of a young, courageous man who persevered over OCD and the Harvard doctor who broke all the rules to help him. I want to thank both of you for coming in. Ed, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Godspeed.
Okay, for more information about OCD, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Just ahead, Law Professor Jonathan Turley on the Supreme Court minus Justice Souter in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Liberal interest groups have already begun to work up their candidate list to fill the seat to be vacated by Justice David Souter this June, the end of the session of the U.S. Supreme Court. Conservative groups have started circulating lines of attack on the likely nominees. Of course, Souter's resignation gives President Barack Obama his first chance to appoint a Supreme Court justice. And while the new justice is not expected to change the ideological balance of the court, this will be the first justice to be appointed by a Democratic president in 15 years. Jonathan Turley is professor of public interest law at George Washington University. Jonathan, you write, let the Supreme Court sweepstakes begin.
Right.
And, you know, there'd been hints that Justice Souter might be preparing to retire. He didn't appoint any clerks for the fall. He's been saying how much he hates Washington and wants to go back to his beloved New Hampshire. But still, you write, this is a complete surprise.
Well, it's a surprise just because he's a virtual teenager in this group. I mean, he is not at the top of the age curve. In fact, John Paul Stevens is 20 years older than he is and does not appear interested in leaving the bench anytime soon. So if you look just at the age and the health of the justices, he was one of the younger and healthiest of the justices. But the reason it doesn't come entirely as a surprise is that Souter has never hidden his dislike for Washington. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who likes solitude. He loves being out in the woods, you know, where his roots come from. He loves New England. And he would go back there. He'd drive himself back to New Hampshire the minute he could get out of the city.
Well, and so now, though, he may be driving, you know, for good. So let's take a look at the number of candidates being mentioned to replace him, including former Harvard Law School Dean Elena Kagan. And you're also writing about Circuit Court Judge Diane Wood from Chicago. Let's start with Kagan, who's just recently been confirmed as Solicitor General of the U.S., so meaning she's obviously a favorite of Obama's.
Yeah, I think that Kagan would be slightly more controversial than some of the other people on the list, except for one, and that would be Sonia Sotomayor, who I think would be even more controversial. But I think that she would get through confirmation. She's obviously extremely bright. The worst that the conservatives could say about her is that she hasn't been on the bench before, but some of the greatest justices in our history did not come from the bench. There's this, I think, misplaced view that you have to be on the court in order to be elevated to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's not like other courts. I mean, it's not, you know, you could make the claim that on the Court of Appeals it might be useful to be a trial judge, but the Supreme Court is really more like a university. It's more academic. It's more theoretical.
Well, but still, we're reading in Politico some conservative reaction to Kagan's name. An anonymous memo condemns her lack of bench experience and also calls her disturbingly out of the mainstream for positions like her opposition to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. She feels it's too restrictive of gay troops and that colleges should be able to ban the military from campus recruiting because of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. So that's obviously going to come up.
Well, first of all, for the conservatives that are writing those memos, I just have two words to give you. Clarence Thomas. There wasn't a lot of...
I thought you meant he was writing them.
Yeah, well, no. But Clarence Thomas didn't have experience on the bench. John Roberts didn't have a whole lot of experience on the bench. He'd only been on the bench for a relatively short time.
Well, I want to get in your thoughts about Judge Diane Wood from Chicago. Conservatives in the same memo are railing about her opinions. She was in favor of allowing colleges to ban Christian groups that didn't allow homosexuals to join. And she also wrote in one opinion that prisoners shouldn't be forced into drug programs with religious overtones.
Well, she would be my personal favorite in terms of the sort of Vegas book on this competition. She was on the faculty with Obama when they were both law professors. She actually has a personality much like Souter's. I've met her a number of times. She's very popular with lawyers, very popular with judges. She's got a wonderful personality, very engaging, and she is as smart as a whip. I mean, she is someone who would have no problem keeping up with the likes of Scalia and others. And I think that she would also be a relatively easy confirmation. There's going to be opinions there that the conservatives aren't going to like. But unless you've got an empty portfolio, someone like Sandra Day O'Connor, who literally had nothing in her portfolio, you're going to have conservatives that are going to come out and oppose anyone they believe is somewhat left-leaning.
Well, you mentioned Sonia Sotomayor from the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The other candidates on the list, Cass Sunstein from the University of Chicago, Deval Patrick, the Massachusetts governor, other governors are being mentioned. Are those, you know, sort of political favors being thrown out, or is that a real consideration?
I don't think Patrick's a real consideration. I think that he, this is something that might be hopeful thinking, but he really does not have the credentials to be on the Supreme Court. Cass Sunstein, I think, would be opposed by civil libertarians. He's very unpopular over his view on prosecuting war crimes, his view of unlawful surveillance. Obama would be sort of sticking a finger in the eye of civil libertarians if he appointed.
He's the co-author of the book Nudge, by the way, for those who are trying to scratch in their heads trying to think. Well, I just want to, in the last minute we have, Justice Souter was a classic case of, you know, we really can't predict what a legacy might be. He was appointed by George H.W. Bush, but conservatives thought he was way too liberal. And you have a story I just want you to share about, you know, how, you know, kind of his, what his legacy might be, but also what his aura was.
Well, you know, Souter was really universally loved by his colleagues and people in the city. He's an amazingly humble man. And he did not, unlike some of his colleagues, really court the press and public attention. He could get on the metro. No one would recognize him.
In fact, when he was home, sometimes people didn't. Tell the story.
When one of his trips back to New Hampshire, he was in a diner, and a couple came up to them, and they made a very common mistake. They thought he was Justice Breyer. And so he didn't want to embarrass them, so he just went along with it. And then finally, one of them said, "Justice Breyer, what's the best thing about being on the Supreme Court?" And he thought deeply and responded, "Well, I'd have to say it's the privilege of serving with David Souter." and that is typical of the wit of David Souter, and that's why he will be so missed in the city.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, thanks for weighing in with us today.
My great pleasure.
Okay, we all will look forward to seeing what the nominee name will be. Well, next week on Here and Now, a microfinance in Africa. Could it help lift thousands of Africans out of poverty or just lead to more debt they can't pay back? That's next week. Still ahead, we'll weigh in on the Kentucky Derby. After the news, Here and Now. Post time is approaching for tomorrow's Run for the Roses, the 135th Kentucky Derby at Churchill Downs. It's the first jewel in the Triple Crown and, of course, the first Derby since last year's tragic ending. The filly Eight Bells, euthanized right there on the track. Our old friend Joe Drape from the New York Times joins us from Louisville. And, Joe, won't everyone be just holding their breath for 2 minutes tomorrow?
Absolutely, Robin. It has really come to the point where the excitement of the Derby is tinged always with this apprehension, especially on the heels of Barbaro. You know, nobody wants to tune in and watch car crashes, you know.
Right, not tragedies. In this sport, right.
Not in this sport.
Well, and we remember Barbaro's breakdown in the Preakness in 2006. He also died. And it was revealed after last year that the Derby winner, Big Brown, ran the race on steroids. Now, you told us then that you believed horses were breaking down because they were being over-medicated. And you've been trying to find out if that's changing. Tell us about your attempts to try to find out.
Basically, we asked all 20 owners of Derby horses to let us see the vet records and make their vets available to us. I mean, veterinarians and surgeons in this field say over-medication is contributing to the fragility of a thoroughbred, not Joe Draper, the New York Times. We asked, and, you know, only three of them turned it over. And I guess commendably, and the most forthcoming was Rick Porter, who owned Eight Bells. And Eight Bells, they had a necropsy. There was no drugs in her system. There was no pre-existing condition. You know, he gave me the records for Freeze and Fire, who's among the favorites here. There are people in the game that want transparency, want accountability. You know, there's a movement to change the medication rules like they are in Europe, which is basically hay oats and water. You know, you really can't give anybody anything.
Right. Well, I just want to ask you, you mentioned the trainers wouldn't give up this information. One even cited his horse's privacy.
Some of the answers induced chuckles like that one. And I think the most alarming ones is I Want Revenge's owner. He said something that was indicative of part of the problem. He said, "You got to talk to my trainer. I don't know what goes on back there." There needs to be checks and balances, Robin, and owners need to know what's going in their horses.
Well, but you also mentioned that it was shown that Eight Bells didn't, you know, have any medication in her. So, you know, what does that do to the theory that it is the medication that's making them more fragile?
It's bad from a marketing standpoint, but horses do die when they are racing, just like they die out in the field. I mean, they've got fragile little ankles, you know. Tragedies are going to happen, but there are things that can be done to reduce the risk of that. You know, I quote the Hong Kong and European breakdown fatalities. They run on turf. They run without medication. They don't run as much. Their rates are a third I mean, America has the worst mortality rate for thoroughbreds of anywhere in the world.
So at least make it better, you're saying. Well, a couple questions for you, Joe Drape. Given the state of the economy, are people betting?
Betting's down. Betting's down about 20% across the board. You know, down here in Louisville, there's empty hotel rooms for the first time in years. The hotel I'm staying in has 100 empty rooms. And, you know, this hotel usually sold out a year in advance for $900 a room. There's no doubt the economy is going to cut into attendance and, I guess, the joy to vive on Saturday.
Well, and as we said at the beginning, you know, so will this, you know, dread that something might happen. But you did a question and answer with readers in the paper yesterday, and you were asked, after all the deaths, you know, what still makes the hair stand up on the back of your head when you watch horses? And you told a story about a horse that you've mentioned, Friesian Fire, which is the one you like to win. Tell us the story about, you know, what that horse did for you.
You know, it's a big crowd. Friesian Fire walks into this big crowd, and he just sort of stops and looks around. And, you know, think of a runway model saying, admire me. And everybody admires him. But then he keeps going, and I'm following along. And it's just Larry Jones, who gallops all his own horses, he's on top of him. And Larry's wife is next to him, and Cindy's reaching out, patting him on the flanks. And Larry's patting him on the neck. And, it, you know, it could have been me and my wife walking with our child. It was just a really quiet moment. There's more people like that in the sport than the ones who cheat. I think there's some karmic justice that Rick Porter and Larry Jones should win it.
Joe Drape covers horse racing for The New York Times. We'll link you to his blog, The Rail, at our website, hereandnow.org. Joe, thanks so much, as always, and enjoy the day.
Robin, enjoy the weekend. Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, Barbie goes to the Derby. We'll explain Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Did you know that Barbie will be at the Kentucky Derby tomorrow? The Louisville Courier-Journal is asking readers to take their Barbie dolls to the race, maybe buy them a mint julep, then snap their pictures and email the pictures to the newspaper. The best photo will win a specially created Kentucky Derby Barbie, complete with a fancy hat. It's all part of the celebration of Barbie's 50th birthday, a celebration that's resonating around the world, even in Shanghai, China. Yes, that's where this is all heading. Mattel has opened the world's first store dedicated to Barbie. It's in Shanghai, and the BBC's Chris Hogg took a tour.
小朋友,下午好,这里是芭比的公主宝座,可以上来体验一下。
Smile, you're a Chinese Barbie. Little girls can get their picture taken sitting on a bright pink throne here in the new Shanghai store. And that's just the start of it. Upstairs, another youngster, dressed as a princess, is parading shyly down a catwalk, much to the delight of her parents, who are snapping away with their cameras. Growing up in the 1970s and 80s, they wouldn't have been able to enjoy anything like this. They look like they're having more fun than she is. Spread across six floors, this is so much more than just a toy store. It's a place that encourages you to embrace a Barbie lifestyle, with cosmetics, fashion, accessories, and all sorts of dainty cakes in the cafe. The manager is Laura Lai.
A lot of Chinese moms, they don't have Barbie in their childhood. So Barbie's appearance actually makes something that they can share with their daughter. It's like a missing part in their childhood. Here you can see that there's a lot of interaction. There's a lot of moments that mom can share with their daughter. So it's not just a young girl's playground. It's also for girls at all ages.
这个呢,你来看。第四版美国土鼠芭比。这是美国的土著人,都有自己的特色,对吧?
This woman is patiently helping her six-year-old identify where each of a string of multicultural Barbies in national dress comes from. I ask her whether her daughter knew much about the doll before they came here.
对芭比熟悉不熟悉呢,我觉得在上海。
I think children in big cities like Shanghai and Beijing know quite a lot about Barbie. Kids from other provinces from further inland are less likely to have the chance to learn about her, though. We didn't know about her till we moved to Shanghai.
Do you think Barbie's going to be as popular one day in China as it is in the West, in America, in Britain?
It
will. It's still quite expensive in China. Sometimes we buy fakes, but as people get richer, I think Barbie will get more popular.
On the third floor, the clientele is slightly older. This is where most of the beauty products and fashion lines are on display. It looks more like a high street boutique than a toy shop. On one side, a young woman is being shown how to apply Barbie cosmetics while her friend looks on.
I came because I saw it on television. I like it. I have a Barbie doll at home. Now that Shanghai has the biggest store in the world, I thought I should come to have a look.
Your friend's having her makeup done. Did you know that Barbie was about more than just dolls?
No, I didn't know before. I came because of the dolls.
The cashiers here are busy. Interestingly, though, it's the blonde, stick-thin, traditional model of Barbie that most people seem to be buying, despite the fact there are other, more Asian-looking versions on sale.
My name is Annie Wang. I'm the managing editor of Shanghai Tattler, a society magazine. In Western world, probably girls after 8, they no longer play with Barbies. But my girlfriends will buy Barbies for themselves as gifts. Oh, carry some like Barbie bags. Because Barbie is very innocent, it's very young. This playing innocent in Chinese women is very popular.
The fact that it's a foreign brand that these young women, your single friends, are embracing, is that in a way a bit disappointing that China doesn't have brands that can compete in the same way?
I think my friends' baby girls, they don't really differentiate Barbies as some Western brand. They see Barbie or they see the Lion King. They see this part of their life. They don't see it as a Chinese thing, a Western thing. Most of the time they are not confused that they're Chinese looking. So it's just another alternative. It's just like they eat Chinese food and they also know about McDonald's.
The people behind Barbie believe China will become their biggest market one day. But whereas it's easy to create excitement with a new store like this, it's harder to sustain it. Barbie's sales have slumped elsewhere in recent months, making it all the more important they get it right here in Shanghai.
The BBC's Chris Hogg in Shanghai, China. Well, we have time for a few of your thoughts now. We recently heard the debate over the relationship between doctors and pharmaceutical companies. We spoke with Dr. Tom Stossel of Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, who said he was offended that anyone would ever think that perks from drug companies would affect his decision-making. And further, he said that close relationships between doctors, professors, and drug companies could lead to medical advances. Well, Richard Kruger of Mansfield, Massachusetts, agreed. He writes, "As a regulatory professional for over 36 years, I can tell you that whenever a physician participates in a clinical trial, he or she must go through an extensive FDA approval process. The pharmaceutical biotech industry spends on the order of $30 billion every year on research, with most years ending with no new approvals. Mother Nature is stingy in loosing her secrets. Removing the pharmaceutical biotech industry from conducting new drug research with schools and doctors is so 1950s. But Russell Brooker, professor of political science at Alverno College in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was one of several who strongly disagrees. He writes, "Dr. Stossel said that doctors are not influenced by pens and other trinkets that drug companies give them. If that is true, why do the drug companies give pens and trinkets? Do they think the medical profession is short of pens? I find it hard to imagine one pharmaceutical executive saying to another, 'Let's send out 5,000 pens with the name of our new wonder drug to physicians so that they won't be influenced.' Maybe drug executives say that every day," he writes, "but I am skeptical." Well, we might add, so is the federal government. This week, the Institute of Medicine, the government's top medical advisor, released its recommendations, calling on all medical professionals, from professors to family physicians, to publicly report any funding they receive, refuse any and all gifts, and prohibit doctors with financial conflict from testing new therapies on people. Let's get a couple last thoughts from listeners. We had a quick question from Erin Moore, listening on NHPR up in New Hampshire. She wrote after our piece on Sharia banking, a new trend to offer devout Muslims a way to bank without the forbidden interest rates. Erin asks, can a non-Islamic customer have access to the same banking? Well, Erin, the short answer is yes. And Annette Shade wrote after our piece on Susan Boyle, the Scottish woman who's taking the world by storm after her appearance on the audition show Britain's Got Talent. Our reporter, Andrew Billen of The Guardian, was one of many who referred to Susan as frumpy. Annette writes, While Susan Boyle is obviously not suited for ingenue roles, she might make a fine Madame Thénardier in Les Misérables, or perhaps even Mrs. Lovett in Sweeney Todd. Let's not discount people because they're not Hollywood beautiful. And Annette adds, thanks so much for your great shows. Don't know what I'd do without you out here in the wilds of Wyoming.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by.
Well, thank you, Annette. Thanks to all who write or call. It's so easy to do. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. What goes through the human mind when it hears music?
When I hear piano music, I see in front of me a large cloud of sky blue mist. There's billowing as the music grows louder, and it goes to the background as the music goes softer.
That's Sean Day. He has synesthesia, a rare neurological condition that causes senses to conflate. In this case, when Sean hears music, he also sees colors, which can also happen when he tastes or smells something. The condition isn't new. Documented cases go back more than a century. But scientists have recently found new genetic information. We're going to hear from a researcher, but first we want to talk with Sean. He's also president of the American Synesthesia Association, and he joins us now from his home in Charleston, South Carolina. Sean, welcome.
Hello.
When did you first become aware that you had synesthesia?
I've had it since as long as I can remember. I know that I was playing around with it when I was 5 or 6 years old.
What do you mean by playing around with it?
I would go and raid my parents' record cabinet, searching for records that I wanted to hear, certain albums, because I wanted to see the colors.
Isn't that something? Did you think everyone did this?
By the time that I was about 6 or 7 years old, I was quite aware that other people didn't. My family was very musical, and we interacted with a lot of other musicians, and nobody else was talking about the colors, so
right.
I figured they didn't see the colors.
As we said, you see color also when you eat certain foods. Give us some examples. I say chicken, you say...
Chicken is sky blue.
How about the smells? I know it's just strong smells, but let's say, you know, gasoline when you're putting it in the car.
Gasoline would be a very dark purple.
Is this something that you like having, or is this a problem?
Well, okay, in general, it's something that I like, but my typical stock response to that is, okay, you've got a sense of smell, and
mm-hmm.
you can probably smell perfumes and fresh-baked cookies, and you've also probably smelled like a really filthy toilet and manure and things like that. Do you like having a sense of smell?
Yes, I wouldn't give it up.
Right. My synesthesia is just like any other. It is my sense.
Well, we understand that, by and large, synesthetes see their condition as positive. But you hear from parents whose kids show signs of synesthesia, and they don't know what it is.
I've encountered quite a lot of parents that get very worried. Parents who are convinced that their child is schizophrenic. I've also talked with teenage synesthetes themselves who are just wondering what's going on with them. It's not the case that that's every single teenager that I've encountered or every parent, but I've encountered some very frightening situations.
Such as?
One child who basically ran away from her parents after she was more or less locked in her room in her house for about 2 years because the parents didn't want her embarrassing the family with her talk about colored music, colored letters.
Huh. Well, and that's part of what's motivated your work with the American Synesthesia Association to get information out, so let's do that. You've told us you see colors from sounds spatially, you know, as you've said, up in the sky or some down by your feet. You see different colors for different instruments. And when you were a kid, one of those records you listened to was Groffé's Grand Canyon Suite, which culminates in this thrilling storm.
Yeah.
We're just listening to a little now of Groffé's Grand Canyon Suite. This is before the thunderstorm.
Yeah, I haven't heard that in like about 15 years.
Really? What are you seeing?
Okay, hang on here a second. There was a flute there beforehand, and that was a very light sky blue color way on up at the top of my vision. It's a woodwind coming up again. It's very sky blue. This is all on a background of strings, and so way in the back there's sort of like a wood paneling of brown.
Wow. We're going to fast forward to the thunder, which is in the last movement.
Okay, timpani's way down low. Whole bunch of very dark blackish smoke. Low brass is sort of a reddish-orange flame. Visually, it's very much sort of like your image of the inferno or something like that. Just fire and smoke and very hellish.
Wow. Now, is this scary for you?
It used to scare the hell out of me when I was a little kid. I loved it.
That's Sean Day, a synesthete. Some of his senses are conflated, so when he hears music, he also sees colors. Same with smells and foods. They can launch beautiful colors. He's president of the American Synesthesia Association. He's been speaking to us from South Carolina. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Richard Cytowic is a neurologist who's been studying and writing about synesthesia for decades. Most recently, he co-authored Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia. He joins us from WAMU American University Radio in Washington, D.C. Doctor, you know Sean Day. You tell us his experience isn't as uncommon as one might think, that about 1 in 20 people has some kind of synesthesia. But tell us about this newly discovered genetic component.
We've known that it's genetic because it runs strongly in family. What's new is that research groups in 5 countries are tracking down the actual physical gene and where and how it's expressed. And the big question is, why are so many people walking around with an apparently useless genetic trait? Because other than being nice and giving you a very good memory, what's the purpose of synesthesia?
What do you suspect?
I think that this is a gene for creativity, that it helps make us smarter as a human race, because what the gene does is hyperconnect different areas of the brain. And the clue arises in the fact that synesthesia is more common in artistic people like Vladimir Nabokov and Billy Joel.
And what can that tell us?
In the past decade or so, it's forced to rethinking about how brains are organized and how non-synesthetic people perceive the world. The senses do not travel along 5 separate channels as we used to think. Indeed, the normal brain is incredibly cross-wired. Synesthesia highlights the astounding variety in which people perceive the world. And this gets to an old conundrum of how do I know that what I call red is what you call red? And the answer is we can't know, but it really doesn't matter so long as we both agree to call an apple red.
Dr. Richard Cytowic, a neurologist who's been studying synesthesia for decades. Most recently, he co-authored Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia. Dr. Cytowic, thanks so much.
Thank you.